Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Remember Tony the Tiger, the Pillsbury Doughboy, Ronald McDonald who bought you hamburgers, Coke, and a free toy in each children's Happy Meal? Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman, and I am your co-host today along with Molly Painshaw. Today, we are speaking with Dr. Debbie Danowski, social science researcher in the field of big food advertising. Dr. Debbie Danowski is an expert on media literacy and food addiction. She holds a PhD in media education at Capella University and is an associate professor at Sacred Heart University, where she has researched and taught for over 25 years in the intersection of media advertising and problematic eating behaviors. Dr. Danowski's research and publications focus on the role of advertising and media in enabling food addiction and disordered eating patterns. She is the author of several peer-reviewed journal articles and most recently her 2023 book, Happy Eating and Food Addiction in American Advertising. Through her research, writing, speaking engagements, and public health advocacy, Dr. Danowski's goals are to spread understanding of how media and advertising can enable food addiction, as well as her goal is to reduce stigma around this disease and highlight evidence-based treatment approaches. Welcome, Debbie.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Before we start, tell us a little bit about your story, how you got into the food addiction area, and what specifically got you into big food advertising.
I come into the food addiction, and I've been in recovery for almost 35 years now. I went to a treatment center in 1989, which is since closed. And I found out that I was physically addicted, and I still continue to be, to sugar, flour, and certain other products. And I think once I found that out, after I, of course, got over the devastation and being locked up for 6 weeks and recovering and all that, a few years later, when I started teaching, I became angry at the way that the commercials, I'd watch commercials and I'd become angry because it made me want the food. And if I ate that food, I know it was going to start a spiral of addiction. And so as I'd watched these commercials, I just didn't really know what to do about it or anything. But then as the years went on and I began to teach more in the media field, I started out in the journalism area and I moved in media studies. I started to realize that there's a lot of tricks out there that are happening that are making us want this food even more. And so these advertisements are worse than I ever thought they were. And I found out more and I learned more and I started to research. And even in was part of my classes, I started to teach a food advertising class. I started to teach an alcohol advertising class. And I just started to learn about how dangerous these ads are. And I think that it's not really that well known how powerful they are because everybody thinks, oh, advertising doesn't affect me. I'm too smart for that. Mm-hmm. And maybe if we saw just one advertisement, that might be true. But yet some experts say that we see as many as 5,000 ads a day. That counts logos and things online and everything. And how can you compete with the power of that when you see that many food advertisements over and over, eat this, do this, do that, and all the tricky messages that are in there? It's dangerous. And I just got angry.
And so how did a book come out of that?
I had written a few articles for different peer-reviewed journals, and I started to look at what was going on. And it just, again, watching all these, I must have probably during the course of doing all this and since I started and continue to research in this area, I've probably seen, I would say, close to 5,000 ads that I studied carefully, not just like in passing like everybody else. And the more I studied them and then the more I read, there are some good books out there. Ultra Processed People just came out by Chris Van Tulken. And that's very powerful about the tricks that are used in measuring your brain images to see when you react most to the ads. And I guess as I read books like this, many before that, I really just wanted to write my own thing because I didn't read anything about the ads. There was nobody studying eating disorder or food addiction behaviors in food advertising.
Can I ask something about that, Debbie? Because as you're talking about this, and I'm thinking about like me putting myself in your shoes and like this process, And I'm just wondering, how did you really study these advertisements, these marketing materials, whatever, without being activated yourself? I really want to know that part too, if we can talk a bit about that. Sorry to interrupt, but yeah, I'm just like, I got to get that in there. I have to know, how did you do that without being like, oh, panic?
I think in the beginning, I was worried about that. And there were times when I could see myself being drawn into the messages and being a food addict. Food always looks good to me, but it just does. But I think because I was so angry, it helped me. And I knew, I kept in my mind that if I believed what they said, then eventually being addicted to this food, it would kill me if I ate it. And I stayed close to my support groups and did things that, you know, helped me to stay in recovery. But there were times when I was triggered, and I remember thinking to myself, is this something you should really be doing? But I was so mad that I just kept going. Like, I just kept looking at it. It was almost like I was drawn to these ads to say, oh, look at that. Look at what they're saying here. I looked more at the messages than at the food itself.
When you said earlier about how people think, oh, I'm too smart for that, I'm not really affected. In the pharmaceutical industry, in the old days, I remember I would be invited to these extravagant meals. And I even went on a resort. This was in the HIV days, where they just amazingly generous to doctors because they wanted us to prescribe very expensive medications. And I remember thinking, I'm going to enjoy this free ride. And I know which meds I like and which ones I don't. Once you get like the spa treatment and the wine, the steak dinner, it's hard to say this person's my enemy once I'm eating their food. Yeah. Intellect is not as powerful as we think. The question I have is, when you thought, I'd like to write this book, did you find a publisher that was like, yeah, what a great idea? How did you get a publisher to respond to that specific pitch?
I'm very lucky in that I chose a respected academic publisher. I don't believe I would have gotten this book published in a popular publisher because so many of them are owned by food companies or merged with food companies. And my editor just recognized that there was a lack of information about this. She recognized the importance of it, and she was very welcoming to the topic. But judging from the way that my journal articles, there were many times when I could tell that the idea of vilifying food advertisements and taking the Pillsbury Doughboy or Tony the Tiger and saying, look how dangerous they are, didn't go over well for some people. And I was used to it from my popular books that I published about food addiction. People don't like to look at the food that means so much to them, even people who are normal eaters. And I think the short answer is I just lucked out that she recognized that there is not any research in this area, or very little.
Okay, so let's talk about the book. The book is called Happy Eating and Food Addiction in American Advertising. And first of all, can you start with this term happy eating, what you mean by that and why you picked that as your central theme?
Happy eating, there was experiments done many years ago with children and television violence, and they called it consequence-free violence or happy violence. And it was that when violence was shown on television, there were no consequences if it was like the hero who was creating that violence. And so they called it happy violence because there were no consequences shown on the program. And I thought that's exactly what advertisements are. It's happy eating. There's no, you watch people dancing around with their ice creams who are thin. Now, if you eat a lot of ice cream and you love it so much that you're going to dance around with it, you're not going to be thin. You're not going to be able to move around freely. Happy eating is really the idea that there are no consequences. You don't see what happens after you eat that food. You're urged, buy one, get one free. Yet what happens if you eat both of them? It's not shown.
That's actually a term, happy violence, that you took from happy eating?
Yes.
Oh, that's really interesting. I didn't know that.
So in thinking about, like you said, so if you love your ice cream so much, you're dancing around, you're not going to be able to eat it. Like this idea of happy violence or happy eating and these consequences that, so they're not seeing it. So that essentially sets people up for disappointment. They're not telling the whole truth. I think about alcohol commercials. They're not showing people intoxicated, drinking and driving and killing somebody. Like they're not doing any of that. As you were doing this research, can you talk a bit more about those tactics and techniques maybe that they use in the advertising world to really get at young people or whoever their market might be?
Sure.
Because that's really interesting. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. That's a great question, because one of the most dangerous is probably one of the most well-loved. It's the use of mascots. We have,
Tony the Tiger, right?
Tony the Tiger, right. He came around in 1951. And from the time that he was introduced, he was popular. He was this black and white character in the 50s. And they made sure that they associated him almost from the point they used him with sporting activities. Tony was water skiing. Tony was watching rugby. Tony was doing all these things that were associated with physical activity. And then we get into the 60s and it continues. And at that point, they used Tony as they started like skiing and gymnastics and things like that. And sometimes the people were famous and well-known, like champions in those sports. 70s, they decided that they were going to show a little bit of Tony's family. You see the little baby tigers and the mom. And so this is the progression of how this mascot has moved into people's lives. And maybe when the grandparents were kids, they saw Tony in the 50s and then their kids saw them. And so it's passed down. And then by the 80s and 90s, we have Tony telling children that they could do anything. You see these commercials where he gives the child a bowl of cereal and all of a sudden she's jumping in water skis over these giant things that probably only professional water skiers could do. And this was like all throughout the slogan was brings out the tiger in you. So if you eat this cereal, then you can bring out the tiger in you and do these amazing things. And that's the 80s and the 90s. And then we go into the 2000s and Tony's a celebrity by then. He's loved by everybody. He gets fan letters. He's real at this point. It took a little while, but they made him into this icon and then who actually goes and partners with professional athletes. So then in 2019, they launched this thing called Mission Tiger. And Mission Tiger, one of the commercials I mentioned in my book, it was done with Jalen Hurts, who's, I don't know about sports, but he's an Eagles quarterback. And so they go around and they're funding programs in middle schools. Now, think about that. Middle schools are chosen very deliberately because elementary schools don't really have that many programs. By high school, eating habits are established. Middle school students are still very vulnerable to having their eating habits established. And so they're funding these sports programs at schools, which looks like a wonderful thing. We're giving money so that kids can be active, but we're giving it based and tied to a sugar-filled cereal and a mascot who is really just designed to sell that cereal. He's not your friend. There were even some people who wrote about how Tony the Tiger, like kids who don't have fathers, confused him as a paternal figure. So we have this paternal figure promoting this cereal. And to me, that is just disgraceful that we're telling kids that they can eat this cereal and they can be active. And you can't. It's one or the other. You can't eat a lot of this cereal and still be successful in sports. And he's not alone. There's plenty of other mascots.
There are. But I think something that's really interesting about Tony the Tiger and you laying out that history is it establishes this trust and respect. And because it's been so long, like you said, it's generational. If I maybe, whatever, like maybe my kids see a commercial and it has to do with cereal and Tony the Tiger's on it, because that same tiger was around when I was a kid, I might be more willing to trust that cereal or whatever, those foods, because I'm like, oh yeah, that was around when I was a kid. And then meanwhile, my parents are saying the same thing. And yes, like talk about like effective, insidious type, like getting in there. It's Smokey the Bear. Smokey the Bear has been around for ever, right? Teaching us about forest fires. And here Kellogg's has teaching us to just, yep, right, bring out the tiger in us, like you said, using sugar and yeah, whatever else goes in there. Sorry, Beer, I cut you off. Go ahead.
That's okay. I want you to answer, Debbie.
There wasn't really a question so much as it's just really interesting how you laid that out and how, I guess, I've never even thought about how that progression can happen and how we can, mm-hmm, just really come to know and trust. And like you said, I remember the Wheaties box with like the Olympians on it or some major sports, right, player or whatever it might be. So like these marketing things too. And again, they're not showing you those consequences. They're not showing you what people look like before they go to the Biggest Loser ranch, right? They're not putting those folks on the box and for very specific reasons, but those are the actual negative outcomes. They're just saying, trust this. Like people trusted the Marlboro Man for years too, mm-hmm, right? And it turned out wasn't so good for us.
Hey.
That's right. And we have Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy. He's been around for a long time too. I think it was 1965 he came around. Kids have been pushing his belly button for how many, yeah, years now? You like it. He's fun to watch. But he also is promoting food that's ultra processed and unhealthy.
So the question that I was going to ask is to play the devil's advocate. Tony the Tiger is promoting bring out the tiger in you. And you can make the argument that, well, that's a good message. And yes, it's attached to food, but it's a great message for kids to hear where they might not otherwise hear it. And that's probably the rationale that they use. And like the Olympians, seeing that, like, it does promote the possibility to children who would otherwise not think, oh, maybe I could become one of them.
Yeah, but those are also the kids who are most vulnerable, the ones who believe they can, who have the least amount of money to buy the ultra processed. And it's hard. It's easy to say, oh, it's parents' fault. And it's not. Parents are busy. The economy for eating healthy foods is stacked against them. So it's just cheaper, easier, and quicker to go and buy this food that doesn't ever, hardly ever goes bad.
Yeah.
It's cheap. And the kids love it. Of course they love it. It's designed to make them love it.
Let's go back then to the, since we're talking about kids, Tony the Tiger, it's targeted to, like you said, middle school. What about some of the other techniques that Big Food uses for kids, like the concept of play? Yeah. Think about the McDonald's has that big thing in the middle of their restaurant where people jump and I don't know what it is. It's some kind of big balloon.
It's a playscape. Yes. But they also have Happy Meals. And think about that. Just the word, just the title, Happy Meals.
Yeah.
Like, eat this and you'll be happy. There's a toy inside. Now, what does a toy have to do with eating this food? So I think the idea originally was, let's entice the kids to eat this food because then they'll eat more of it and they'll want the next toy. And it's always a toy that's part of a series. So you have to eat more. You have to keep going back every week to get the next one in the series. And it's really effective for kids. For the age group that it's targeted at, it's very effective. And we have animal crackers. Think about animal crackers. They're actually a toy. They're made shaped like animals. There's a lot of things like that that are very subtle, if not in the product itself, then in the commercials. You watch these cartoony commercials. Fruit Roll-Ups has a great commercials with some kids and some cartoons and special effects mixed in, and how they make these fruit leathers that are so processed that there's not even any fruit in it, really. They say real fruit because, yes, at one time it was, but by the time they got done with it, it has no nutritional value.
Yeah. And then like beyond even like kids and play, like sometimes it's the like relaxation and self-care. It's like, oh, you deserve a break today. Go get a Kit Kat, breaking off these Kit Kat pieces or whatever. And yeah, again, like a big problematic issue for people who are vulnerable to these messages.
And those are targeted more toward the adults who are so overwhelmed today. We started with You Deserve a Break Today in 1971. And that's really like, that was McDonald's commercial. You Deserve a Break Today. That was their adult target audience. You don't have to cook anymore. It's too much for you. Here, you deserve a break. Eat this food. Same thing, KFC, very early on in the 50s, started with, let the Colonel cook for you tonight. And those are messages that really hit so many people then and now, because we are busy. We are overwhelmed. The other side that we never see advertised is it doesn't take very much to open a bag of salad or to go into the grocery store and get the even the beans that are pre-cut and steam them, put them in the microwave bag. It doesn't take a lot, but nobody's going to advertise that. They're going to instead try to get you to get the Dove ice cream bars. They were part of International Self-Care Day on July 24th, and they offered like Dove ice cream bars in with mini facials and meditation stones and things like that. And there was a limited amount. So they made it sound like it was this special thing. And still, self-care doesn't involve eating food that's not healthy for you.
That also makes me think of as Dove chocolates. When you open them, like the packages have like little, like wonderful sayings inside of them. Mm-hmm. Oh, like you're so great, or like some sort of like little like mantra or self-affirmation. And like another way that they're just like, oh, this is you doing a beautiful thing for yourself. And look at this little message that comes with this chocolate. It's crazy.
There's this another commercial that where you see the woman in the bathtub and she's relaxing and she's eating, I think it's chocolate. And she's sitting there eating. And this is her way of taking care of herself, a bath. And I think it was, it might be a cookie. And it's like, that's the whole premise of this self-care relaxation theme is that this is something good you're doing for yourself, and it's not.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Bethany here. Have you ever heard of the Enneagram? Have you ever wondered what it is and how it can help you in your recovery? Have you been a bit curious or even confused about what number you are? I like to think of the Enneagram as the owner's manual you wish you were born with in order to understand your own operating system. We already know that the journey of recovery is about knowing yourself, knowing your patterns, your behaviors, making changes to get unstuck, and then breaking free from habits and patterns that aren't serving us. And the Enneagram gives you a roadmap for this very process. This is why I'm super excited to bring you a new Sweet Sobriety workshop about the Enneagram. In this workshop, you'll have the opportunity to learn about the Enneagram and how it can help you in your recovery and discover your own Enneagram number. Over 4 video sessions, we're going to cover what the Enneagram is and how you can use it to accelerate your recovery, the 3 centers of intelligence, the gut, head, and the heart, and which ones are dominant and repressed for each of us, our basic core desires and core motivations. These are the things that propel us into behaviors that might sometimes be mystifying to us, our core fears, and the childhood messages that we received and the ones that got lost. There will be homework assignments and downloads included, as well as a resource list to continue on your Enneagram journey. This will be a very personalized journey, and we will have a chance to discuss what you're learning in 4 live group coaching sessions so that you can level up your recovery and be more at ease with yourself and the world around you. The workshop will run in May of 2024 with live sessions at noon on Wednesdays, May 1st, 8th, 15th, and 23rd. And if you're listening to this beyond the spring of 2024, it's not too late. You can still access the home study for this course on the Sweet Sobriety website. So the cost is $50 US. You can visit sweetsobriety.ca to register. The Enneagram can act as a map to our inner work. I would love to support you in looking at your map and determining how to use it to get to where you want to go. Hope to see you there.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
I want to go back to the Happy Meal. You mentioned that Happy Meal worked for kids, but then I don't remember when it was, but not that long ago, Happy Meal for adults too, like this, because adults liked it so much. And I have to admit myself, when I was eating anything in sight, that going to a McDonald's, I was really thrilled by getting that little thing that I would throw away in 20 minutes. But this little prize. It was very smart to get the adults hooked in as well.
Yes, they did. They introduced an adult Happy Meal not too long ago, and they sold out completely because the adults were so nostalgic for the Happy Meal. And it does matter. Those prizes matter. And you'll see that a lot. This or for kids and for adults. Buy one, get one free. A deal. It always makes somebody feel good.
What about your concept of the King Baby Syndrome? Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. That's the idea of I want what I want when I want it. I put it in the rebellion chapter because there was a 1984 commercial. I don't know if you remember. It was for Wendy's. And there was an older lady, Clara Peller, and she said, "Where's the beef?" And she became so famous for this, "Where's the beef?" And that was like the King Baby Syndrome. You're not giving me what I want. There's not enough beef here. And then there was just so many things. Have It Your Way came along a little while later for Burger King. You know, you have the right to have your fast food the way you want it. So you could choose what was going to go on your Whopper. And all this fits into that idea of I get to eat what I want when I want it. It's all about me. They even had in 2020 in UK, they called it the Rebel Whopper, and it didn't have meat in it. That was like the rebellious part of it. But there are so many things that, you know, that rebellion part, that it's my way. There's a cereal, Magic Spoon cereal. They say it's the better for you cereal. And you can't process something that much, and it's never going to be good for you if it's processed that much. Probably it is a little bit better than some of the others, but the idea was you're not too old to eat cereal. This is an adult cereal, so you could rebel against that. And it's that all ties into that King Baby, which is synonymous with addiction. If you're a food addict, you want things your way. You want your food exactly the way you want your food, and you want it now. You don't want to wait. You put fast food with that, and there you go.
That kind of campaign captures the times, which is that we are becoming more and more self-obsessed and wanting to want what we want when we want it. But also, it feeds into this whole food addiction syndrome. The main focus of your book is how this actually promotes and holds food addiction. So let's start talking about that.
Sure. I think it actually is designed to encourage addiction. It's the same thing with alcohol. What is it? 95% of your consumers are from like 5% who are alcoholics. And it's the same thing with food addicts. You want food addicts addicted to your food. You want them to eat more. You want them to think of this food as the mascot, as their friend. You want the food to be so important to them that they just keep coming back to this food.
And then not to mention, like you were saying, I want what I want and I want it right now. thinking about all that and tying it into food addiction syndrome, what about all the apps? I mean, that we can DoorDash, Uber Eats, I don't even know. And then they're like individual little third party local to you. I think like here it's called like Cafe Courier. And I think Cafe Courier around here was like a thing before, long before Uber Eats or DoorDash. But you combine those things, those qualities of I can have what I want in the exact way that I want it, when I want it, and people will just deliver it to your door. Take a picture of it, let you know it's there. You can open your door, you never have to talk to anybody. You can just do it all as a little keyboard warrior and nobody's ever calling you out on your consequences. You don't have to look somebody in the eye and have them maybe like question, are you sure this is what you want? Like none of that. I don't know. Did you come across any of that in your research?
Yes. I think that what you're saying is absolutely true. And if you think about it, when I was active in my addiction, we didn't have drive-thrus. There was no such thing as a drive-thru even, never mind somebody bringing it to you. And I remember the deep shame that I felt when I would go in and buy all this food. I used to feel like I had to make, there's a bunch of us today or something like that. Like I used to have to make up excuses. And now it's easier than ever. And I think in a lot of ways in the delivery of the food, but also in the encouragement. Some of the food commercials will also include, not usually as main characters in the commercials, but they'll include some people who aren't necessarily perfectly thin. And for me, I look at that as this is giving people who are food addicted or who do suffer with obesity, it's giving them permission to eat this food because there's somebody like them in the commercial. And so I think that these commercials are working really hard to normalize that and to get away from any kind of health consequence. There's a study done where they showed that if you put thin actors in commercials, then people believe that the food is healthier than it actually is. But then the other side of that is you would also mix up in some maybe who were a little bit overweight so that you could say, you know what, it's okay, she's eating it, so I can eat it too.
Yeah, it's very diabolical. They present food is addictive and yet will deny that it's addictive. We say, hey, your food is addictive. No, it's not. You have to moderate. So this whole campaign of, I bet you can't stop at one, this whole teasing about, hey, this is addictive, but it's not really. Can you elaborate more on that? And what is that doing to us as food addicts?
I think it's the most dangerous thing it's doing for food addicts is it's making it all normal. And I think one of the best, and for me, I would say most devastating examples of that is on New Year's Eve in 2021, Skinny Popcorn introduced what they called it a debut music video on YouTube. And it was titled Whole Bag Kinda Night. And there were these four women of various sizes. There was one that was overweight. There was one that was of different ethnicities, sizes. And they all sang about how they were going to, it was an upbeat, professionally done song. And they all sang about how they were going to spend the night with their whole bag of popcorn and eat the whole bag of popcorn. Now, for me, that's a binge. I'm a food addict and that's a binge. And so you have like people sing, it's a night of popcorn and it's a whole bag kind of night. And they're singing that over and over. And one of them in the tub with her popcorn. One of them, it's just me and my popcorn tonight. And to me, that was, they didn't even call it an advertisement. And it went on for a minute. It was released on New Year's Eve, which is a time when many food addicts might isolate and be by themselves, feel very vulnerable. The name of the product is Skinny Pop Popcorn, yeah, with the word skinny in it. And they say, oh, it's healthier. And if you look at it and you just get the regular, plain, normal flavor, it's probably not that bad to eat the serving size, which is like a cup, but it's not a whole bag. But then they have other flavors that have sugar in it and have all these other things in it. And as a food addict, you're not going to just stop at the one that's just the regular flavor. And I think the idea that these advertisements normalize this behavior that kills people. Food addicts die every day from overeating, from eating whole bags of things. And here we are having these four women say, this is how I'm taking care of myself. Me and my popcorn.
As a food addict, if I'm spending my evening with a bag of popcorn, that bag of popcorn is done in a half an hour. I'm eating five or six bags of popcorn. It's not one. So a whole night of popcorn is more than the serving size that they're suggesting, for sure.
It's true.
Do you have anything to say about that campaign of, quote, that you can't stop at one?
Yes, they are telling you and making it normal, though. In the same way when you're saying, bet you can't eat just one, which is a Lay's potato chip slogan. Yeah. And when they're telling you that you can't eat just one. There was even a commercial and they used two famous basketball stars. And one was Larry Bird. And I think, I can't remember who the other one was, but they used two of them and they made a bet. He said, I bet you can't eat just one. He had to shave his head because he couldn't eat just one. And so if a famous basketball star can't eat just one and he had to shave his head, then they're making it okay. Like they're making it okay that you can't eat just one. They're encouraging you to eat more than one. That's the bottom line.
What do you think about the whole, in this context, the body positivity movement? Do you think that there is an interplay there? The idea to normalize obesity, basically. Not only normalize, but celebrate.
But I don't know. I want to be really careful about that because okay. I don't know that is the intention of body positivity or like fat acceptance. I don't think that the way that we're framing it, I don't know that is the intention. That may be how it is playing out. But I want to be really careful about that too.
I think we have genuine people who are promoting it, but I think the people who are funding it are, I don't know, Debbie, if you have something to say about that, the funders of it are actually food industry.
That's what I think. I think that there are some people out there who are very well-intentioned. I'm one of those people, inclusivity, acceptance. I totally am on board with that. And I think that there are companies out there, food companies who fund that and use that to their benefit that don't have the same good intentions. It's the same thing when you include someone who's overweight in a food commercial. I don't believe that's about inclusivity or acceptance. I think that's about denial and encouraging people to eat. So I think they're two different things. The body positivity movement, I applaud. However, when it's in a commercial for ultra-processed food, I don't believe that's any kind of advancement. I think that's actually going in the wrong direction.
So would that be how you would help somebody determine that? Okay, if you're seeing this in a commercial for a food product, it's being used to manipulate you. But if you hear about it or see it in what kind of way, then it might be more about acceptance and inclusivity. How would you lay that out for anybody who's listening?
I think that the first thing, and this is all about what's called media literacy education. Being media literate is exactly what it says. You look at who's producing this message, what's behind it. And so I think those are the questions that have to be asked. I'm a firm believer in looking at not only the messages in advertising, but in all things. We have a lot of behaviors in films, television shows, and other media that is also encourages addiction. You watch a romantic comedy and they break up and he smokes and she eats, or he drinks and she eats ice cream. And that's how it goes. And so we've normalized that. And I think we need to, as a society, from like day one, the second a child enters school, we need to educate them about the media and the messages in the media so that they can make their own decisions, especially advertising. And my belief is that advertising is the most powerful force in the media, and much more powerful than we give it credit for. And I think we need to have media literacy education and eating disorder treatment too, because if we're not looking at the messages out there, we're drawn into them. When I first got into recovery, I had to write as part of my, I would say what I was going to eat, and I had to make a commitment that I was not going to watch soap operas because the commercials were too much for me. The commercials that appear during daytime television are even more addictive for the foods because those are the people who are home, who are watching television during the day. And we have to be careful about that. So I think when we're talking about the media, we have to really examine the messages.
And also who's producing them, as you said.
Absolutely.
I'm just curious to know, are there media literacy curriculums out there currently for like elementary age school children or middle schoolers or high school? Do those exist, or is that something that's needed?
There are some out there. There are organizations that promote media literacy. There's a big movement to get that included in schools, but it's not an easy. I have colleagues who are actually working on that, but it's not an easy road because adding anything to the school day, I think, is just a challenge because there's so much to do in a school day. But I also think that we now have soda machines in schools. We now have lots of things in schools, and some schools are changing. There's a lot of funding from food organizations or even the lunches that are given. There's a lot of changes that would have to take place for people to really get on board with that. And I'm just not sure that there's a willingness to do that right now.
Yeah, I think about all the parents that might be listening to this episode going, I want my children to know more about this, and I'm willing to go to the school myself or to the PTA or to whoever it might be and get some sort of grassroots movement going. So if these curriculums already exist, that is good information, right? So then they could seek those out and see what they could do. I think parents can do pretty much anything. Like, I see changes all the time, school year to school year. I have young children, one in elementary and one in middle school. And every year, the parents often are the instigation for big changes. So I think we could get, maybe not nationwide. That might be a big stretch or a big wish. But I think even these little pockets of parents here and parents there, we might get something going. You never know.
Absolutely. More power to you.
I just want to add to that, that I work in a treatment center for drugs and alcohol. And in one of the centers, there's a vending machine of garbage food. And the guys are like, oh, that's great. I get to eat that because I'm not using my drug anymore. But the insidious message there is one that is already in drug and alcohol addiction, which is, if you're having a craving, it's okay to have food. Instead, treat the craving. And as a matter of fact, there's the vending machine to help you out. So it's an insidious message right there that it's okay to overeat on bags and bags of jujubes and whatever else is in there.
It's in the big book too. The Alcoholics Anonymous big book says, if you have a craving, have candy.
Yes, I know. It's frustrating. And Molly, they know me already. They know me. And I tear my hair and I say, what's this vending machine doing here? I'm not a parent, but I'm a person there. And they just say, it's business anyway.
But I think that if you could get patients on board, right?
Yes.
Or like previous patients, yes, or the rest of the staff on board, I think that there could be something,
yes,
there. You against them, I get it. If I were to go to the school myself, they might be like, oh, thank you. Good job. But if I went to the PPA and I got all the moms, the ones with pull, I think moms can do a lot. Look at Moms Against Drunk Driving. I think that women, when we are really passionate about something, I think that we can make it happen. It's just a matter, mm-hmm, of getting the right people together that have the right influence. And so I think you could, Vera. I really do. You alone, I get it. They're like, no, thank you. But I think with Debbie and me, other people who work there, clients, get some of those men on board.
Yeah,
I think you could make a change. And maybe the vending machine doesn't go away, but maybe the options that are in the vending machine change.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So we've talked about a few campaigns, the You Deserve a Break Today, the Play, the Rebellious. What other campaigns haven't we touched on that you might be able to talk about that the big food in advertising uses?
Oh, there are campaigns that have lasted for the years, some of which we've talked about, but there are also the individual commercials too, which might not be part of an entire campaign for decades, but the same message is being shown. We have, I think, one of the things that really recently was an issue was when COVID, during the pandemic, food became even more important. There were shortages, and a lot of advertisers, food advertisers, took that opportunity to present themselves as the answer. We have Post Cereal did an ad where they called it a bowl of cereal, a bowl of something familiar, a bowl of we're going to be okay. That's what they associated. They said how their workers were working on getting the cereal to you and all this other stuff. And think about that. A bowl of we're going to be okay during a national pandemic. That's a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're seeing images of their workers going out during this pandemic, working to get that cereal to you. And then during that time, we also had a grape nut shortage, which is made by Post. There was a big shortage for a while. And so they write, oh, everything, we just want to remind you we're still here or something. But then all the other ones are saying it's a bowl of we're going to be okay, you know. And then we have Oscar Mayer, who we don't often think of ultra processed food as being like hot dogs and things like that. But it is. That's ultra processed food, too, with the stuff that's in there. And they put out the Oscar Mayer front yard cookout because we couldn't see each other. We were under quarantine. So let's go outside. We could see each other if we sit in our front yards and we look at our neighbors and, of course, have Oscar Mayer food. Enjoy a meal together safely. And then they also are going to donate money to Share America. There's the incentive. Like, what? That's a really good thing to feed people who aren't able to have enough money to eat. However, why do we have to do it through an ultra-processed food company? Why can't we just donate ourselves? So that there's the incentive, like the false incentive is to buy this product and we'll donate. When really you could just donate yourself. You don't have to buy that product. You could just donate yourself. It justifies the overeating. It justifies the addiction. It justifies all the other things about that food that make you, okay, so I'm helping somebody else and I'll buy it and we'll sit out in our front yard and we'll have a picnic. Those are all wonderful ideas. However, the purpose of that is not to make people feel better. The purpose of that ad is to sell that food. And it's the same thing with all of advertising.
That's the same thing as what we were talking about a little bit earlier with the body positivity. The intention is actually very good. And we bought that. So where do we draw the line? If the intention is good for inclusivity of that or when COVID, because we're all isolated, so what with a few Oscar Mayer wieners? I'm just throwing this out as a devil's advocate. They're very clever because they're saying this is a public service announcement attached to the Oscar Mayer wiener.
It is, but it's that whole idea of you put a little bit of truth in a lie and then everybody believes it. Yeah. And it's like that. You put a little bit of truth in there, a little bit of good. You offer to donate. And there were plenty of food companies during COVID who did donate money to charities to feed people. There were several. And that's a wonderful thing. And so there's the good part. But however, the other side of that is you have to buy that food in order to get that money donated. And so it's dangerous to those people who are eating. Ultra-processed food, by definition, is unhealthy. Like, it's food that has all these fillers in it. It's not real whole food. And so if you have to buy this ultra-processed food in order to get that donation to go to that charity, you're putting yourself in danger and you're justifying overeating that food. Because if you're going to give money to charity, why not just buy two or three or even four? So it's a little bit of good, but with a whole lot of bad.
It really highlights the need for that media literacy approach, which is exactly what your book is doing.
Which I think for me, as we're having this conversation, it just makes me even think about, like, why do we need commercials for food at all? Like, we are wired to eat. Like, and turns out we are already wired to do that. We are already going to go seek the food. So why do we need these commercials at all? We're going to go look for it. I get why we have it, right? Because somebody wants to sell their specific product. McDonald's wants to sell their Happy Meal. Burger King wants to sell their Whopper their way, whatever it might be. But I think just like taking a step back and as a consumer saying, how can I vote with my fork or with my dollars, so to speak, right? Is why do I need advertisement whatsoever? When I'm hungry, I have to go to the kitchen and figure out what my next meal is. And if there isn't food there, then I need to figure out, am I going hunting? Am I going grocery shopping? What am I doing? And then I do the next thing. And so do I need a commercial at all? I think it's just, I guess, a bigger way, a bigger picture, taking a step back and saying, do I need to media literacy? Yes. But if somebody's advertising something to me, they're just trying to sell something to me. I could just go to the store and pick up a tomato and an onion and a whatever and put that on my beef burger and I can make it myself. And then I know what's gone into it and whatever. And it's okay. Do I need to watch these commercials? Do I need to trust Tony the Tiger? I guess it's just, I'm just having these bigger thoughts of, do I need all of that? Or can I maybe figure it out?
But that's why we have them coming into all these other areas of our lives, because the more important they could become in our lives, if we have to go to McDonald's to entertain our children or to get them a prize, then they've become a part of our lives. And this is where the nostalgia trap comes in. We start to think, oh, we always went to wherever, whatever place it is. We always went there for the holiday, or we always ate this. And so then, because it's one bad habit is passed down through a generation, and then it becomes not just about the food. It's not just about the hamburger. It's about the type of hamburger. And it's about the company making the hamburger. And they have to do that in order for us to be susceptible and to need them. They want people to need them. If Tony's into schools and he's funding sports programs, then those schools already need to have that funding from Kellogg's. And that's an issue. That's a big issue. We have Ben and Jerry's is a really good example. They're very environmentally aware. When we talk about one of the sections in the book is about social causes and the things that happen. They did a commercial in 2015 where they showed melting ice cream and they said, this is what happens when ice cream is just 2 degrees warmer than it should be. And it's all this melting ice cream. So it's talking about the earth. And they're saying they released the Save Our Swirled ice cream flavor to encourage action on climate change. How does eating that ice cream really encourage action to change the climate? There's much more effective way. They want to get in the middle of it. Well, as do all companies want to get in the middle of it so that we need them.
How does social media exaggerate this effect?
It makes it much more available. When you're on social media, anybody who's ever done a Google search knows that you do a Google search and then you go onto Facebook and you're going to have 10 ads for that, whatever it was you searched for. It's right there. It's in your face. It's more in your face. They can reach you right. Say Sunday morning, you get up and check your social media and there's a waffle company that says, good morning. What a great day for a waffle. And it's right there on your social media. People like them. for kids, this is the danger for kids. They have these things that are called advergames, and they're advertising really, but they're games. Get the, I don't know, find the ice cream hidden in the whatever. And it's at the websites and kids have to play these games and they get all involved in the game. And really it's about a product. So the internet makes that possible. Social media encourages them, like our page and learn more about where Tony's going to be this tomorrow or whatever. So it just makes it more personal, seem more personal. And children who don't have the ability to understand that mascot isn't talking directly to them, but to everybody, take it really personally.
There's the opportunity for regular people to become adverts themselves, like the social media influencers. They pay you to speak a message, and you essentially are advertising. So it's the regular person, the guy next door, being silly, promoting that product.
And then it goes viral and it's promoting it even more, probably even powerfully than maybe a regular ad on television that you would be suspicious of.
Yes.
A lot of people don't realize that social media influencers are paid to promote these products.
There was a whole debacle last year, maybe when it came out that there were a bunch of dietitians, nutritionists, somebody being paid by big food companies to promote some of this stuff as well. Maybe I'm remembering it wrong. Do you two remember that?
Vaguely.
I don't remember anything specific to that, but I do know that these people that are getting viral views are getting a lot of help to do.
And they include dietitians, nutrition, right? Like people who elevate themselves as experts in nutrition or food in general. And then they're promoting these products, all foods fit for all people. And they're promoting this thing. So it's almost like a double whammy, right? So it's not just my neighbor having a viral video while she's eating her swirl ice cream to save the earth. It's also these people who have podcasts and books and are interviewed on TV, all of the, and then they have these social media platforms. And then it turns out they're actually getting paid by big food, whomever it might be, to promote these things. And we need to be aware of that as well.
Absolutely.
So Debbie, if I were to summarize your book, please correct me if I'm wrong. You're trying to show how advertising promotes and fosters food addiction behavior by normalizing it and by exposing us to it, giving us permission to eat in a way that we would otherwise not want to eat. Would you say that's a good summary of your book?
Yes. And to make people aware, by pulling out the individual advertisements, I have analyzed them, and by really looking at them, thinking about things that we won't normally think about.
In a very academic way, this is a very rigorous book in the way that you've constructed it to show exactly what you're saying. So what is your hope for the book? And did you get any pushback from this, from your book? It came out last year. What would you like to see?
My hope is that it will make people really think about the ads that they're seeing instead of just accepting them and as just something that's there and thinking that they don't matter, because they really matter. My hope is that media literacy education would be included in schools across the country, that it would also be included in eating disorder treatments and food addiction treatments and even alcohol. It could be included in any kind of addiction treatment. That's a lot of hope for one book, but and maybe it's a starting point.
Have you had any pushback against your message?
It only came out at the end of October, so no. I think the message that people maybe want to ignore a little bit and that they don't want to bring attention to, because it's easier to continue as we are in some ways, to continue with eating the food that's convenient, that lasts forever, that doesn't take a lot to prepare. So I think any kind of pushback would just be in the continuation of what's been going on.
The whole concept of media literacy, you really expose from the underbelly. I don't even see this stuff. I just take it for granted, exactly like you said. And you really illustrate by dissecting these things, this crafted campaign, and which I think is very useful for us. So what is next for you? Or is it a bit too soon to ask that question?
No, actually, I am working on another book that's similar to this. When I was writing this book, the health chapter was the biggest chapter. The messages about health and ultra-processed food, the advertisements were so tricky and there were all these different techniques. So I went to my editor and I asked her, and I'm working on a book about, it's called Health Halos, which are the real fruit pictures with unhealthy food. And so I'm working on that to look at things like the way that they use the words all natural, real fruit, no sugar added, those kinds of advertisements, and product labels this time too. I want to look at product labels.
Ah, so the same kind of systematic examination, but now looking at the health halo effect.
Yes.
As you're saying that, I've been thinking about one particular influencer who likes to talk about healthified. My recipes are healthified. This food is healthified. Mm. And that just makes me think of that. Oh, it's so sneaky. It's so sneaky. Yeah, totally.
That's why it's successful.
Yes. And we wouldn't do it if it, right? Like whomever would not do it if it didn't work. The mm-hmm. same for us, right? We wouldn't do our behavior if it didn't work. So absolutely. So before you go, we do have a signature question. And I know we've had you on before. So you're crafted this question a little bit differently this time. So if you could tell a younger version of yourself something about Big Food and its messaging or the advertisements, that kind of thing, what would it be?
I think it would be in my best interest not to listen or look at any of these commercials if I could help it. But I don't know, because I can remember being so addicted and just looking at the people in the commercials and wanting to look like them and be like them. And somehow it got all muddled in my head that if I eat those things or I did those things, then maybe I could finally get some sanity or peace of mind. And I think it probably would just be not to watch them. That would just be the easiest thing. Not very realistic, but
yeah, hard to do. And that's all that in kids shows. That's all that they show. Thank you so much. I think we're done. Unless you have something you want to add, is that maybe a message of hope for the listener?
First, I want to thank you for what you do, because I think it's very important to make people aware of food addiction and all the dangerous things that are out there to encourage us to be addicted. And there is hope. The three of us are sitting here in recovery and there is hope. And there's much, much more information out there than there's ever been. So I'm very grateful for that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life Support Group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.